I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hours later, Guilfoyle awoke with a start. His befogged mind had registered something, but he didn't know what. He'd drained the rest of the gin before he felt the sharp pain in his left hand. As he jerked the hand up to his mouth, he heard something scuttle away. He threw the bottle after the sound when he tasted blood on the back of his hand. It began to throb, and the taste of his own sticky blood made him retch. He rolled onto his side as the gin began to pump from his body and laid there while his body shook. Suddenly, he felt the pain again in his outstretched left hand. He shrieked when he realised something was gnawing at the tendons.
Rats! His mind screamed the words. Rats! Eating me alive! God! God, help me!
Welcome to the Curiously Specific Book Club, the podcast that's curiously specific about dates and locations in well-known books.
Every podcast, we like to take a book out into the wild to see if the world of fiction matches up to the real world. Hello, I'm Tim Wright. I'm a digital writer and immersive producer, producing immersive and interactive fiction.
And I'm Lloyd Shepherd. I'm a digital producer and writer producing non-immersive fictions that you just pick up and read. We slightly got the giggles there with that reading from James Herbert's The Rats.
You're meant to be terrified.
You're meant to be terrified, but it is terrifying.
You are, listener. We're going to spare you all the gory bits.
Well, we thought we'd read you a bit that led into a gory bit to make clear that we're not going to read out any gory bits.
No, and they get pretty gory.
They get pretty gory. This is James Herbert's first novel. It's about, obviously, rats. And a massive outbreak of a new mutant strain of killer rats in the
huge
east end
as
of
well.
London.
They're sort of two or 3 foot long.
Yeah, massive rats.
Massive rats.
It's also, so we're going on a bit of an east end adventure for this trip. Mm. We went on an amazing walk. We're going to cover places in Whitechapel, Stepney, and we're going to end up at the canal, the Regent's Canal, on the boundary between Stepney and Poplar. We're actually going to finish up at the lockkeeper's cottage, which is ground zero for the rats.
I wasn't happy to know that was a real place.
Which you weren't. But I wanted to do this book because I remembered it as being an absolute thrill ride when I was a teenager, you know, a young teenager. It was the kind of book that people read and go, "Have you read The Rats? It's really gruesome." But you it came out in 1974. I think you probably read it. Did you say you read it pretty soon after it came out?
Oh, yeah, because obviously by that stage I was well entrenched in boarding school. And that was very much a book to be passed around in the dormitory.
Yeah, very
mainly good. Because, obviously, how old was I then? Yes, I must be 10 or 11. The main issue in that book for 11-year-old boys all huddled up together in a dormitory was how many times the rats attacked your private parts.
They do seem to have an uncanny ability to go straight for the gonads.
Which was obviously the most terrifying thing you could think of aged 11.
Absolutely.
Somebody coming for your private parts.
Nothing more
especially
scary.
Especially in a boarding school.
The old warriors used to gather every night on one of the few remaining bomb sites left in the east end of London. It was an old churchyard, just off the busy main road of Whitechapel and quite near Aldgate East Underground Station. It was thick with shrubbery and littered with open tombs. A single tower was the only remains of the once majestic church. That night, six of them had gathered, safe in the knowledge that they couldn't be seen from the road. All were slowly destroying their insides by their incessant drinking of methylated spirits. All had reached the depths of despair, had given up the will to exist with the rest of the world. They rarely spoke to one another. Their tormented minds were too occupied with their own misfortunes to concern themselves with anybody else's. This is a bomb site of St. Mary Matfalon.
St. Mary Matfalon. Very famous church, actually. So we are in what is now called Altab Alley Park.
Altab Alley Park.
Just off the Whitechapel Road.
We're in the East End of London, and we are between Aldgate East and Whitechapel Underground stations. South side of Whitechapel Road.
I can see the Lloyds building from here. You can see the city and the NatWest Tower. You're on the edge of the city. There was a gateway to the East End.
The reason this is no longer called St. Mary's Churchyard is a rather sad reason. It's named for a young Bangladeshi textile worker.
Yes, Altab Alley.
Who was killed in 1978, I think.
That's right.
In a racial attack. So the church was burnt out by an incendiary device in the Second World War.
Yes, bombed out, but the tower was still there.
The tower
as
was
mentioned
still
in
there.
That reading.
Yeah.
The tower was still there, but derelict. That was then cleared in the 1950s.
Okay.
And it became St. Mary's Park. And so it was rededicated
so
after the death of
Altab
Alley.
So it's probably worth saying James Herbert grew up just around the corner from here.
Okay.
We think.
Yeah.
Presumably played in the bomb site.
Yes, when the tower was still
When
there.
The tower was still here. And actually has not actually noticed that by the time the book is set...
Well, if we think it's set in the
late 60s, early 70s,
there's
no tower
here. If you come to this park, actually the main sort of area of seating is the outline of the old church.
Yeah, definitely James Herbert has been here, probably as a child.
Played in here,
but
in
I don't
the
think he ever came.
Site.
He didn't came back to check up his check, room, oh, the check tower's his memories.
Gone. The tower's gone.
Yeah, the tower's gone. But it sounds like when he was playing here, when it was a bomb site, there would have been a lot more kind of masonry and rubble lying around, bit more foliage, bushes, shrubs. They crawl into the bushes, don't they, when they're being attacked by the rats?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a really, really gruesome scene. This place is interesting because it combines all sorts of themes of the book. Right, it's got because of the stuff that's happened here, it's got the racial aspect. It's close to the scenes of the Ripper murders. It's close to where Herbert grew up.
It's definitely rat's country.
It's what?
Rat's country.
And it's rat's country.
Well, the one thing that doesn't change... So you've had the church here, then you have St. Mary's Park, then you have Altab Alley Park. It doesn't matter. A bomb drops on it. There's a racist killings. It doesn't matter what you do. The drinkers and smokers will always be here.
Well, yep, they're out today. It's a Monday morning.
There's something about certain spaces that once you've got a tin in your hand, you're drawn to that place.
So James Herbert, author of The Rats, born on April the 8th, 1943.
War baby.
Third son of an East End street trader. He talked about his family living at the back of Petticoat Lane, which is a road that runs up through the East End. And he described it in, I've got a fantastic book here, which is full of absolute gems, called By Horror Haunted, James Herbert. Edited by Stephen Jones. It's basically a hagiography. It's a whole bunch of people telling you that James Herbert is really, really great.
Okay.
And it's just an indication of how massive he was in the 80s in terms of publishing numbers, because his publisher obviously commissioned this to keep him happy.
Right.
So there's little bits of him getting up in the morning, describing his breakfast.
What we lived in was a slum. This is James Herbert talking. It's not, it's me talking, but it's James Herbert's words.
Are you doing your East End
accent? It was a very narrow street, cobblestoned, only gas lighting in those days. Two doors from our house, there was a little alleyway where Jack the Ripper cut up one of his victims. Mm. We moved into this slum because it was due for clearance, and we thought we could get a nice council flat. Well, they didn't knock it down until 14 years later, so I spent 14 years in that place. Yeah, so he was there till 1957. Mm. So I reckon that might be Miller's Court he's talking about, which is where Mary Jane Kelly was killed in 9th of November 1888.
You mentioned that when we were in the
Because the woman who dies in the park, in the graveyard, is called Mary Kelly. So obvious kind of connection there.
Yes.
Now, if it is Miller's Court, that means he lived on Dorset Street. Now, Dorset Street has got the reputation of being the worst street in London.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It disappeared in... The north side of it disappeared in 1920 when they were building Spitalfields Market, where the south side wasn't demolished until the 60s.
Okay.
He attended a local primary school, got a scholarship to St. Aloysius College in Highgate. He went to school, not in the East End.
No, that's interesting, isn't it? That he headed north and out of it.
And at 16, so that's about 1959, he went to Hornsey College of Art.
Yeah.
Got his first job in a small advertising agency by pretending to be someone else. Joined a big ad agency 2 years later as a typographer, and then was promoted to art director. Then he was group head there by age 26 in 1969.
Yeah, he's very much an ad man. 60s ad man.
60s ad man. Yeah. A couple of years later, started work on The Rats.
There you go.
So that's the quick James Herbert biography.
If you go on YouTube, there's a very good This Is Your Life episode of This Is Your Life with James Herbert, which I enjoyed very much. Two things. One is he's got two brothers, and one of his brothers did a little recording from the fruit and veg stand that he was still running while his brother was, you know, multi-millionaire novelist.
Yeah,
his big brother was still running the family stall.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. He does say that in that Dorset Street where he grew up, he said he could hear the cats and the rats fighting.
He does talk
outside,
about that.
Because the rats are coming to get all his fruit and veg, his parents' fruit and veg. So in his childhood, he said at night, that's what he'd hear, is the scrabbling of the rats and the yowling of the cats. So that's quite good, isn't it?
It's good, isn't it?
I saw an interview in The Guardian with him from the 90s when he's very successful. He does seem to go more, as he gets older, into the idea of being the sort of father of horror. Yeah. And that being his brand, as it were. I suppose that's the advertising side of him, is that he becomes a bit of a brand. But it doesn't stop him being a bit chippy about how people, our critics, have been mean to him. He's interviewed in the mid-90s, so 20 years after The Rats has come out. He's still rankled by Martin Amis's review of it in The Observer in 1974. Martin Amis wrote, "By page 20, the rats are slurping up the sleeping baby after the brave Bow Wow has fought to the death to protect its charge. Enough to make a rodent wretch, undeniably, and enough to make any human pitch this book aside."
Wow.
Well, obviously, Herbert went on to say, oh, well, I sold a million copies, so what stuff
you... What are you going to do about it?
But he was... relevant to us is that we've just done Woman in Black by Susan Hill. So this is in the mid-90s. This is still 15 or 10 years after Susan Hill's success. He's saying, Herbert need not worry too much that he still lacks literary cachet. "I'm not into high literature, but I think all my books are literate. Susan Hill writes ghost stories. I make no comment about those ghost stories, but because she is part of the literati, they are elevated." So he has just made a comment.
Shall we go to school in the East End, James Herbert?
Yeah.
Well, James John Herbert, this is your life. And it started Hackney Hospital in London's East End on April the 8th, 1943. You're the third son of fruit and veg market stallholders Herbie and Kitty. Well, your parents' fruit stall is a family tradition that's been carried on by your eldest brother, Peter.
Well, hello, Jimmy.
Oh.
Remember years ago, you used to go down Ridley Road? I used to buy the comics. I used to buy one and borrow a few. Then I used to take your pictures. See the X films, Spunk You In. And the horror films, H. Don't make them now, not like that.
Speak so well.
And I think it was an instigator of you doing what you do now.
Yeah, I think
And
so.
If you could see your way clear, because the game's a bit hard at the moment, in the supermarket, I'll be very thankful. Have a lovely night tonight, and I hope to see you later on.
Sir, in the playground, there's one of them things. He gesticulated towards the window, his eyes wide, smiling in his excitement. The whole class rushed as one towards the windows. Back to your seats, Harris roared, and strode quickly to a window. He drew in a sharp breath at what he saw. There wasn't one of them things, but several. As he watched, more joined the first bunch, huge black rats, the rats. They crouched in the playground, staring at the school building, more, then more. Close all the windows, he ordered.
It's the attack on the school. He doesn't name the school. There's a few candidates around here, but there's one in particular that is in the right location in terms of the canal.
Yeah, where the rats come from, as if they're going to attack.
But also, Keogh gets bitten in an earlier bit.
Keogh, the school
by
kid.
The canal, one of the kids. Harris, the teacher, takes him to
London Hospital.
The hospital outpatients. So we've just walked down Stepney Way,
yeah.
Essentially from the old London Hospital outpatients to the school. So we like this school.
Oh, yeah, very
and
much so. It leads then straight to the canal.
Stepney All Saints School.
Yeah.
It was formerly known as the Sir John Cassis Foundation and Redcoat School. It was actually founded in the early 18th century by Sir John Cass. Well, the thing about him is he was a big, big player in the early Atlantic slave trade.
That's where his money came from.
That's where his money came from. And so they changed the name of the school in 2020 in the aftermath of the George Floyd murder.
Oh, right, OK.
They changed it to Stepney All Saints School. And it's been redeveloped, as a lot of big secondary schools have in London.
Yeah.
Still got a bit of an old building around the back, which you can imagine having kids screaming at the windows and going, there's rats in the playground,
sir, there's rats.
So the rats attack, and Harris continues his mystifying journey as the kind of the central figure in the rat
action
attacks.
Action man.
In London.
One man against the city of rats.
He's an art teacher, isn't he?
He is,
which
grudgingly.
Which is interesting, when James Herbert obviously went to art college and then was an art director for an advertising agency. So Harris is clearly, you know, Harris equals Herbert, right?
Pretty much, yeah. He's coming from King's Cross to sort it out.
One thing I do want to talk about with this school, the Stepney School. Do you know about the Stepney School strike of 1971?
No.
This is a very good story. So this guy must be the model for Harris, to my mind, right? This is about, in May 1971, Chris Searle, a young English teacher, was sacked by the governors of Sir John Cass Foundation School in Stepney for publishing Stepney Words, a collection of his students' poems. Searle had encouraged his pupils to write about their lives and their neighbourhood. In response to Searle's dismissal on the 27th of May 1971, 800 pupils, including those from neighbouring schools, went on strike. With banners aloft and chanting, "We shall overcome," in the pouring rain, they refused to return to school until Chris Searle was reinstated. He was reinstated in 1973. It took to sort of 18 months. 1971, these kids were encouraged to write poems about their own experience, and they wrote about deprivation and the terrible housing and violence, and they wrote about probably rats and stuff.
Yeah.
And obviously the school did not like it that they were allowed to express themselves about what... It wasn't good PR.
No.
So they sort of banned the poems and kicked the teacher out.
Let it flow, Joe. Let your feelings speak for you. Let the people know what you know.
They're the honest words of young EastEnders which got this former teacher the sack. Chris Searle taught English at Sir John Cass School in Stepney back in the 70s and encouraged pupils to write poetry about their lives.
They looked at their area, they saw what was good about it, but they also saw what was bad about it. And that's what came out in their poetry. Quite a lot of their poems talked about bad housing, because at that time, housing in this area was quite grim for some families.
So The Rats, published in 1974.
1974.
Now, we quite like to give some context to these books by talking about what else was going on the year they came out.
Because we have done 1974 before, but in a series,
Tinker Tailor
Soldier Spy, of course, came out.
So another book with practically no women in it. You said to try and keep it light.
Well, only because we've got some rather grim stuff to come. So
yeah, but I think it is quite grim. Just to set the tone, that in the 3-day week,
yeah,
miners' strikes, IRA bombs going off all over the place,
yeah,
Guildford, Birmingham, miscarriages of justice, 2 general elections in 1974,
yeah, twice the fun.
So let's just chill out and talk about music, shall we?
Yeah, go on.
1974. A golden age for glam rock.
It was. It was very much a glam rock year.
Mud. The Cat Crept In. And Tiger Feet.
The biggest selling single of the year was Tiger Feet.
Tiger Feet. Band on the Run. Come on.
Yeah.
Band on the Run.
Second biggest selling album of the year. After, yeah. You know what the first biggest selling album of the year was?
No, what was that? Dark Side of the Moon, surely.
Carpenters, the singles.
Oh. And do you know what everybody was doing in 1974?
What?
Everybody.
Go on.
Everybody was kung fu fighting.
They were. Oh.
The other big thing that's relevant to rats, I think, and I want your opinion on this.
Okay.
What is a womble?
A womble? Yeah, remember you're a womble.
Yeah. Is a womble a form of rat?
Oh, that's a good shout.
That goes around cleaning up rubbish.
A cleaning up rat.
And doing good things.
Oh, I've never thought of it like that before. They are quite ratty to look at.
The Wombles by James Herbert.
Or be a crossover. The Wombles meet, yeah, the rats.
Underground, overground, wombling free.
Tearing your tendons and biting your knees.
Well, there's some debate as to whether they're bears as opposed to rodents.
When you
rodents.
Say there's some debate, what have you been reading?
Well, I'm starting it.
I see.
I'm starting an internet meme.
About whether they're
womble,
bears.
Rat, okay. Or bear.
All right.
They were big, though. The Wombles were big.
They were. They had a couple of big selling singles in 1974.
Well, she started.
It was essentially glam rock, though, wasn't it? When you listened to it.
Remember you're a womble.
Remember you're a womble.
Remember what a womble, womble, womble you are.
Diddly, diddly, diddly.
It's very memorable.
Yeah, very
she
good.
Started publishing those stories, Elizabeth Beresford, in 1968.
Oh.
Just so she's sport.
Lord Lucan disappeared.
That's a good one, isn't it?
And John Stonehouse was found. Did you know that happened in the same year?
That's a bit weird, isn't it? There were some ideas that John Stonehouse was Lord Lucan.
Well, the Australian police thought he was. That's why they arrested him. They thought he was Lord Lucan.
That's just ridiculous.
John Stonehouse was a British MP who faked his own death and then disappeared because he was bankrupt, wasn't he? He ran out of money or something?
Lucan.
No,
yeah.
Stonehouse.
Oh, Stonehouse, yeah.
Lord Lucan disappeared around his nanny being murdered.
And yes, he had a horrible gambling.
Still never been found.
Yeah, well, I think he just zoomed out in his speedboat into the channel and fell over, didn't he?
Yeah.
I think that's... the other ones I've got on the publication, Jaws.
Oh, really? Peter Beresford?
Benchley.
Benchley.
Peter Benchley.
Elizabeth Beresford.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Beresford. I always get those
no,
two.
No, that's
up.
Good. That's good. That was the second Wombles book.
Jaws. High Windows was published this year.
Oh, was
Philip
it?
Larkin, yeah.
Dogs of War, Forsyth.
Dogs of War, I loved that film, that book. I can remember that book.
Thought you would.
Now, so we've had some fun with that, but actually there was also some pretty dark stuff going on, particularly in the East End.
Yes.
We opened this in Alto Valley Park. It's worth dwelling a little bit on who Alto Valley was and why it was important. So Alto Valley was a... I'm getting this from a fantastic article on Open Democracy, opendemocracy.net, called The Racist Killing of Alto Valley 40 Years Ago Today by David Rosenberg. So Alto Valley moved to London in 1969, worked in Hanbury Street off Brick Lane. The Bengali community was already expanding at that time.
Very much so.
And moving into where the sort of the old Jewish immigrant population... I mean, that part of the world had been solidly Jewish for a long time, and that lots of the Jewish people had moved up to North London.
Yep.
Alto Valley moved in and worked as a teenager with his uncle. He returned to Bangladesh in 1975 for 5 months to be married and came back to England. Bride stayed in Bangladesh. She never came to the UK because on the 4th of May 1978... he was still only 24 years old at that point.
Wow.
He was walking home from work along Adler Street alongside St Mary's Gardens, which is the churchyard. He was attacked and stabbed by 3 teenagers whose minds had been poisoned by racists. Later at their trial, they would say they attacked Ali because he was a quote-unquote packy. Now, the day he died was local election day.
Yes, it was.
In 1978. And again, as in 1974, the far-right National Front, which had only been formed in 1967, it ran in every ward in Tower Hamlets, and it gained nearly 10% of the vote. Ali's death caused a huge consternation and anger in the Bangladeshi community, and there was a march. There was a march across 10 days later. Local restaurants and workshops across Tower Hamlets closed as 7,000 Bengalis marched to Downing Street and Hyde Park. They marched silently in the rain behind a vehicle carrying Altab Ali's coffin. The East End is changing out of all recognition at this time.
Yeah.
A lot of people are moving out. There's a character who says in the book, the poor woman whose baby gets taken to pieces by the rats, they'd been lucky to get a place so quickly, dingy though it was. It was in a bad area, too near the docks, but they'd lived in Poplar most of their lives anyway, so it didn't make much difference. And it certainly wasn't a slum. Paula made sure of that. Other houses in the street may have been neglected by their tenants, but hers was spotless. Soon, though, when they saved enough money, they'd move out to Barking or Ilford, not too far from Mike's job at the garage. Now, that's a lot of what's going on at the moment. A lot of the white families are moving into Essex, moving east.
Yeah.
And a lot of immigrant families are moving into the East End. Herbert sort of alludes to that a couple of times. He talks about the coloureds a few times.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really talk about that happening. You know, it's like...
There's one point where he says that coloured people don't come in from... They're at West Ham and they don't take the tube
They don't
further
pass
in.
West Ham. Now, Keogh, who's in his class and gets bitten by a rat, Harris says, he was halfway through the first lesson when Keogh walked in. He wore his usual uniform of short-sleeved check shirt, braces holding his trousers at half-mast, showing the full length of his heavy boots. So Keogh, I would say, is a skinhead.
Yeah, I didn't spot that. That's very good. Interesting.
There's a real, you know, the culture of racism. You know, you saw a skinhead in 1974, you basically saw a racist.
Well, just about that history of racism, it just goes deep in the East End, I think it really does inform the book. It's just that I hadn't realised that actually the first sort of MP in 1902... The MP for that area, Major Evans Gordon, claimed that not a day passes but English families are ruthlessly turned out to make room for foreign invaders. The rates are burdened with the education of thousands of foreign children. He said that in 1903.
Yeah.
And I have to say the other thing about that, about disruption, about they regularly went down Brick Lane and smashed up Pakistani shops.
They did.
But quite once they did it just after Enoch Powell had come to the area to make a speech. You're listening to the Curiously Specific Book Club podcast. If you support us on Patreon, you can get this podcast ad-free, and you can also get part two straight away rather than having to wait for a week. Just go to Patreon and search for Curiously Specific and sign up.
If you subscribe to our Patreon account, you also get a bunch of other stuff. You get our show notes, which are very detailed, and they have more information about all the places we've been to. You'll also get a whole set of pictures and videos that we take while we're on our adventures. And we also write some extra posts about things around relating to the books that we only put on Patreon. It's quite a lot of stuff on there that you just don't see if you're not a subscriber.
Yes, and we'll be drawing maps as well and giving you a guide so that you can use our material to have your own adventure out in the East End. Won't that be fun?
So check out patreon.com, search for Curiously Specific, and you'll get access to all this good stuff. But for now, back to the podcast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
He was greeted by Foskins himself when he arrived at the address he'd been given. It had turned out to be Poplar Town Hall, a natural enough base for operations, he supposed. Foskins led him to a large assembly room, the walls covered with enlarged maps of the area, diagrams of the underground and sewage networks, blow-ups of the giant rats themselves, vivisected as well as whole, even photographs of their spores. The room was a hive of activity, but Foskins took him over to a group of men gathered around a table in quiet, unexcited discussion. So we are...
Poplar Town Hall.
It's on the Bow Road. This is the Bow Road, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a big old road. It's very noisy.
Yeah, low traffic.
It's probably worth saying, Poplar Town Hall isn't really in Poplar.
No, it's in Bow, mate.
It's in Bow.
Obviously.
It's not the Town Hall anymore. It stopped being the Town Hall in 1965 when Tower Hamlets Council was formed. If the Rats is set any time after 1965...
It should be a story about Tower Hamlets.
He's got his town hall wrong.
Yeah. It was still used by council operations, wasn't it?
Was it?
Yeah, until the 80s or something. I think okay. They still used it as council offices.
It's rather a lovely...
It just wasn't the town hall.
It's rather a lovely 1930s building.
They claim it's the first big municipal building in Britain built in the modernist style, i.e. Well, slightly...
It is horribly neglected now.
It's late 1930s. It's got some amazing carvings on the front of sort of workers.
Yeah.
It's almost kind of like, you know, Russian realist artwork on the front.
It's really spectacular.
Yeah. If you're into architecture, the outside's worth having a quick look at.
It's worth having a look. Get the DLR to Bow Church. Don't get it to Poplar. Because it's a very long walk.
There was a Poplar Town Hall on Poplar High Street, but not. And then in the 1920s, it moved out here,
which is sort of just a very clear indication about how messy the whole use of land was.
Also, a clear indication that James Herbert isn't too fussy about where he sets up operations, right? In his book.
So after their meeting, they have their meeting at Poplar Town Hall, and Harris remains, again, mystifyingly at the centre of everything going on. They say they crossed the road from the town hall and entered a pub just opening its doors for the early evening rush. Their eyes adjusted to the gloom reluctantly after the bright sunshine of light afternoon. What will you have? Foskins asked, reaching for his wallet. Keg. Pint of keg and a gin and tonic, please.
Ah, the class war.
Yeah.
The class war, gin and tonic and keg.
Did we get a little bit of East End barracking then?
Yes.
He
was trying to make a joke that we were look like sports commentators, but all he could shout in his cups was Bobby Moore.
My god.
Now so I know what that pub is.
We know what the pub is, don't we? Because
it's the Bow Bells.
It's the Bow Bells, immediately opposite the town hall.
Yeah, it's not that dark and dingy, is it?
No, it was rather nice.
I suppose maybe back in the day they would have put frosted glass and curtains over it.
Yeah,
and it might have been a bit darker, but it's actually quite a pleasant pub. Did you know it's haunted?
It's haunted,
yeah,
by traffic noise.
No, it's haunted by the Phantom Flusher. Why are you laughing? And do you know when it started? Basically, apparently what happens is... I'll let that ambulance go. It started in 1974.
Okay.
In the ladies...
The date of publication
in
of the
ladies' Rats. Lavatory in the Bow Bells. Is that if you sat down there to do your business and then it would randomly flush and catch you by surprise. So if you're into hauntings, it's funny that it started in 1974.
Yes.
What I'm thinking is they had a problem with the drains. Anyway, the good news about this book is there are no women protagonists in it at all, so the ladies' lavatory is never going to feature, is it?
Well, there's Judy, his girlfriend.
Yeah, but that's it, right?
Yeah.
There are no women doing anything of any authority
there
in this book at all.
No, it's
right?
Extraordinary.
No teachers.
No.
No police force. No, nobody.
They're
victims.
There's not even a woman teacher mentioned as the staff room scenes.
Exactly. So it's very poor on that score.
It's a male world.
So
it's a white male world.
Nobody in this book is going to become a victim of the phantom flusher easily.
No.
Unless they're in the ladies' toilet for another reason.
Well, nobody anywhere is going to fall victim to the phantom flusher. So, ipso facto, no one in the book is.
You're a sceptic, I know.
Yeah.
We've been led astray with this site, I feel.
Yeah, I think it was worth coming here.
It's not a good place.
No.
It's not
filling us with vibes, is it?
Well, if you're trying to find all the places on the Regent's Canal where rats might be and attack and plan them, why have you set yourself up here? It's nonsense.
It is nonsense. Foskins paused, indicating that Harris should take a seat, then went on. The brown rat seems to have vanished from London. Since the brown rat is unable to climb as well as the black, over the years it has had less chance to survive in the city. Whereas the black rat is able to scale walls and leap across rooftops, the brown has found it increasingly harder to gain access into premises that have barriers against them. For years, the two species have been battling for superiority, and now it appears that the black have won. We found no trace of the brown, not even its spores, which are quite different from those of the black. It's natural to assume that the introduction of the freak giant black rats tipped the balance, interrupted one of the group of men. Yes, rather like a small country acquiring the hydrogen bomb, continued Foskins. Well, it seems they completely vanquished the brown rats.
It's just nonsense, isn't it?
Well, as far as I can tell, that's utter nonsense.
Yeah, yeah, it's the black
rats.
It's
the other way round.
Yeah, the black rats.
The brown
extinct.
Rats have vanquished the black rats in London.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, absolutely. So the brown rats are the ones that have thrived.
There's actually three types of rats in London.
Oh,
so the black rat, Rattus rattus, also known as the roof rat, the ship rat, or the house rat.
Oh, very good.
Probably spread across Europe in the wake of the Roman conquests. It had the primary role in spreading bacteria during the Black Death.
Yes.
From fleas on its body.
Fleas.
Now, the brown rat, as the Stranglers noted, is called Rattus norvegicus.
Yes.
Bigger and more aggressive than the black rat. It's also known as the common rat, street rat, sewer rat, wharf rat, Hanover rat, Norway rat, Norwegian rat, and Parisian rat.
Oh, right.
Now, most of the reason it's called that is because, you know, Londoners and British people are racists. And they wanted
they're
the Hanover
foreign rats.
The Hanover, they wanted
no
to call
British,
it the Hanover.
No British rat would be behaving like this.
Well, they started appearing in the sort of 18th century when that, you know, House of Hanover was taking off the crown and they were like, you know, the House of Hanover was associated with rats. They started calling it the Hanover rats.
Of course, because of Hamelin, of course.
Probably arrived during the 17th or 18th century and rapidly took over from the black rat. Generally displaced the black rats in areas where humans lived. It's larger, it's more aggressive. And they prefer damp environments such as riverbanks and canals.
Of course they do.
Okay. The third type of rat first appeared in London in 1976. Came from Ireland.
Yeah.
Didn't become widespread until the following year. Threatened to overrun Britain before finally disappearing in 1986. Which, of course, the Boomtown rat.
Oh, shut up.
But yeah, so he's got brown and black rats the wrong way around,
well,
as far as I can tell.
He's basically ratist anyway. He's terribly ratist. Rats aren't that bad. I sent you.
I've got an example of them being quite bad.
Oh, have you?
But you carry on. And
well, I sent you a really lovely link to a woman called Dr. Donna Keane,
right,
who trains rats to save victims trapped in collapsed buildings after earthquakes. They kit them out with a rat backpack and train them to trigger a switch when they find a victim and come back for a tasty treat. There is another kind of rat, of course, and it's the lab rat. And I didn't realise this, but they are a different species of rat. Did you know that?
There's something like 57 different varieties of lab rat, aren't there?
They are, very stocks and strains. But they're all based on a particular... The Wistar rat. The Wistar rat is an outbred albino rat. So we know that at the end of the book, the master rat is an albino rat, right? The Wistar rat... was developed at the Wistar Institute in 1906 for use in biological and medical research. More than half of all laboratory rat strains are descended from the original colony of Wistar rats. So all the lab rats of the world come from this one
Wistar Colony.
That's quite spooky, isn't it?
That is quite fun. And the reason, of course, there are variations of them is obviously they then breed rats for particular forms of medical research. So there's the Long Evans rat, developed in 1915 by crossing several Wistar females with a wild grey male, utilised to model stuff around obesity. The Royal College of Surgeons rat, they have their own rat. And then the shaking rat Kawasaki.
That goes really fast, that one.
A mutant rat. I found a really interesting article on the Boston Public Library website about the military history of the rat war in Boston that's been going on for decades.
The rat war?
The rat war, the people struggle. The war on rats in Boston. It's been going on since the beginning of the 20th century. They've been fighting. But then in 1961, there's the Battle for Back Bay. Called it Doomsday for the Neighbourhood's Rats and praised the campaign's annihilation plans. Total extermination is the goal. They got really obsessed with it, apparently, in the early 60s, and it was a really big thing. Well, the thing is that's interesting about this to me is this article then goes on to say that through this Boston Rat War, this became the language by which you basically talked about rats, was military language. So that you would always talk about continual surveillance and the target area, days gnaw at people who live here. So the whole metaphor becomes
the days gnaw at people who live here.
Wow. Yeah. In 71, the city wasn't content with holding the line against the rat menace. The war bosses of Boston ordered staff of the Model Cities program to join the fight for a block-by-block battle to reclaim territory from the old enemy. That's in 1971.
He stopped dead at the spectacle before him, his mouth hanging wide. Millions of rats swarming all over the station, and big ones like those he'd seen in his own country, but even bigger. His mind didn't even stop to evaluate. He ran without looking back. There was only one place for him to go, the stairs being cut off by a struggling mass of vermin. Without hesitation, he ran down the ramp and into the dark womb of the tunnel.
Oh, we went down there.
His fear drove him straight into the approaching train, mercifully killing him before he was aware of death's presence.
Wow.
Oh, I think he runs down there.
It's
on the northbound platform. So we're at Shadwell Station on the London Overground. Yes, confusingly, it's called an underground station in the book because it was part of the East London line back in the day. But it was an underground station.
It was.
So this is where another rat attack happens on the Sunday evening before the carnage at Stepney Green Station the next morning.
Well, Black Monday, as they refer to it.
Black Monday. Dave Moody is getting the train home after seeing his girlfriend.
Yeah.
He comes down to Shadwell Station. He sees the station, a station worker, a coloured station worker, to use the language of the book, came into view and walked towards the other end of the platform, entering a door marked private, which we think... So it's been relaid out, Shadwell Station.
Yeah, the records show that the entrance was on the side street, so on the main street of Cable Street.
The entrance is now flagged on the station as the emergency exit was the old entrance.
Yes, you'll see... If you come down here, you'll see a very old stone arch, which is clearly more than an emergency exit in its day.
Yeah. And then at the end of the platform, which is now the way out, would have been where the station master's platform was.
Yes, and there's several office doors there, aren't
there? Several offices up there.
So Dave comes down those steps, comes to the station, sees there's a load of rats, tries to run back up, and is overwhelmed by them.
Yeah.
Then the station master comes down the steps where the current exit is.
Yeah.
Sees the rats, millions of them, and presumably then runs back towards his office, but down the tunnel.
Yeah.
And that's an oncoming train.
That's exactly right.
Him.
So it's quite good, isn't it?
That kind of works.
Shadwell Station wise?
Yeah, so this might be one place where Herbert's actually sat here and worked it out, don't you think?
But this is more his manner, isn't it, than over towards Poplar and the Canal?
I think that's what we're discovering.
He grew up
really
in Whitechapel.
Yeah.
So that, you know, the Whitechapel is one stop along from Shadwell on the overland. Now the overground, what was the East London line. So this is one stop away from where he grew up.
By the end of the week, the biochemists had come up with the correct virus. They laughed at the teacher's admiration for their speed. That wasn't the problem, they told him. You see, we've had the virus itself for many years. In fact, We inherited it from the Germans after the war.
Mm. Along with the Triffid seeds.
So that got me thinking about the viral research and viral warfare.
Yes.
And so I was kind of looking at...
What did you find?
But there's this guy... Did you read about Kurt Blomer?
Nope.
So Kurt Blomer was a high-ranking Nazi scientist before and during World War II. Now, the story basically goes he was researching cancer as a cover for researching viral warfare.
Okay.
He worked on methods of storage and dispersal of biological agents like plague, cholera, anthrax and typhoid, and also infected prisoners with the plague in order to test the efficacy of vaccines. So, you know, lovely stuff. He escaped from Poznan in January 1945 ahead of the Red Army, relocated to Western Germany, and brought all his biological cultures with him from Poland.
How nice.
And was still promising Hitler a Wunderwaffe, a wonder weapon that would turn the tide in Germany's favour. He was arrested in Munich by United States counterintelligence, spent some weeks in custody, taken to Kranzberg Castle. A secret message was transmitted to Operation Alsos, an Anglo-American team of experts tasked with investigating German-Italian weapons technology. And the message said, in 1943, Blomer was studying bacteriological warfare, although officially he was involved in cancer research, which was, however, a camouflage. He additionally served as Deputy Health Minister. Would you like to send investigators? So it's basically believed the Americans saved him from being executed.
Yeah.
In exchange for information about biological warfare. He was hired in 1951 by the US Army Chemical Corps. He was not arrested or charged with war crimes, again, after his acquittal. He continued to practice medicine in West Germany and was active in politics as a member of the National Conservative German Nazi Party. German Party, sorry.
Come on now.
He died in Dortmund in 1969. So there's that.
The other thing, 1969. Then what happened to his samples?
Well, exactly.
But the Japanese, they used to drop. They had ceramic bombs filled with fleas charged with bubonic plague, and they drop those
on the Chinese, right?
Yeah, which is like that's just weird, right? A flea bomb.
Later on, they talk about where did these rats come from, and they track it down to this chap, Professor William Bartlett Schiller.
He sounds a bit German.
He spent several years in New Guinea and the surrounding islands, apparently investigating reports of mutant animals seen by locals.
Quite right.
It seems quite feasible for an island in that area had been used for a nuclear test.
I can't
find any indication of nuclear tests in New Guinea.
No, there isn't
the
any.
The British were testing nuclear Absolute weapons nonsense. In Australia, Western yes. Australia, which is new.
In the late 50s.
In the 50s, and also in the South Pacific.
Yeah,
the Americans were in Marshall Islands, South Pacific, and Nevada, obviously.
Yeah,
and the French were all in the South Pacific. None of that's near New Guinea.
No,
what he's on about?
So the sort of nuclear dread thing—that's just a sort of nuclear dread conspiracy theory, isn't it? Don't you think? Apart from,
and rather a weakly researched one, I would say.
Well, you say that.
Oh, go on. Go on.
So you know, talking about a land of time forgot.
Yeah.
And how that was all cut off. Yeah. In the film, Doug McClure comes across an island where dinosaurs live on because they've been cut off by volcanic activity. And also some weird new creatures have evolved.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm on the Smithsonian website, as I normally am, and I come across, dated 2009, new species of giant rat discovered in crater of volcano in Papua New Guinea.
No.
A Smithsonian Institution biologist has discovered a new species of giant rat on a filmmaking expedition to a remote rainforest in New Guinea. He's clearly not that threatening because there's a picture of him just cuddling up to it. Apparently they're very, very tame.
It's huge.
Because they've never met human beings. So they're very, very tame and they're not scared at all. They are now referred to as the Basavi woolly rat. It's one of the biggest rats in the world.
Okay.
It's completely tame, and it lives in an isolated crater.
I thought you said an isolated cottage.
Isolated cottage, yes. Silvery grey with thick woolly fur, vegetarian diet. Well, they think that now.
Yeah.
Give it time.
Give it time.
But it's funny, isn't it? Is it basically said the discovery came in the middle of the night after searching in the crater's chilly mountains. It's basically because it only lives in one volcanic crater and involved in that one crater.
Wow. It's never gone out of the crater.
Well, we don't know that, do we?
Well,
Somebody.
Okay, well, maybe.
Somebody a bit German may have packed one up and brought it down to
Did James Herbert know in the early 70s? They didn't discover. How did he know about that? Years. It's amazing.
It's weird, isn't it?
It is weird.
Why has he picked New Guinea?
I'm slightly creeped out by that.
Why has he picked New Guinea?
Have a look at this. Oh, gosh.
This is the world's largest rat.
That is the biggest rat I have ever seen.
That is a murid rat, a true rat, the same family as the rats you find in cities and sewers.
You've got a big smile on your face.
The reason I'm smiling, Gordon, is that this is absolutely a new species. Okay. This is something that doesn't have a scientific name. This is one of the largest rats in the world, and here we are holding it.
I just think it is an amazing creature, found nowhere else on the entire planet.
Over the years of rush hour travel, Henry had become an expert on where people lived. It didn't work so well in the mornings, he rarely got a seat, but in the evenings he would position himself in front of the person most likely to get off fairly soon. For instance, the scruffier person, the sooner they reached their destination. Coloured people never went further than West Ham. Well-dressed people often changed at Mile End for the Central Line. So we're at the Stepney Green.
We're at Stepney Green Station.
This is Stepney Green Station.
And in the book, there's an attack between Mile End and Stepney Green. So the train heading into the city, full of workers, on a Monday morning, 8:30, it catches a fire. It's never adequately explained what caused the fire.
A faulty cable, maybe. You'd actually heard of rats chewing through cables.
So they come, they get off the train, and as they're walking up the tunnel towards Stepney Green Station, the rats attack them.
Yes. The next station, Stepney Green, wasn't very far, so he would get them off the train and up the tunnel. But with so many passengers, it would be dangerous. It would be better than have them panic in the confined spaces of the carriages. And yet, what happens? I noticed they still have a guard on the tube train. It mentions the guard.
It does.
Which actually were being phased out by 1974. Guards on trains.
Right, but they still had them.
On some lines, yes. But again, I feel maybe Herbert is harking back to a time where there was a guard on every train.
I feel Herbert may have stopped taking the train, the tube by this time.
He probably hadn't noticed that the doors open automatically.
Yeah.
That would have been a revelation to him.
I know. The other thing that he doesn't mention in the book is that actually, because it's the district line, this is the boring trainy thing.
Yeah,
so it's a double track tunnel. So most tube lines in London have a train, each track has its own tunnel. So if you were walking down in towards Stepney Green along the tracks, the trains from the other way would be coming towards you. Never mentions that, does he?
No.
So all I can think of is they wouldn't have stopped the trains because they wouldn't have known at that point the rats were attacking.
No, that's right.
So actually he's missed an opportunity there because he could have had rat death and then a train ploughing through from the other way. Could have been absolute carnage.
That's a very good point. He could have had double trouble. As they stumbled on, they saw rats feeding on the corpses of men and women, people who had set out to work, thinking it would be the usual Monday, minds filled with small worries and small joys, never expecting to die that day.
That was the end of part one of our adventure into James Herbert's The Rats.
We've managed to avoid most of the scary bits for you.
There are more scary bits coming in part two.
Yeah, but we're not going to do the
Bits.
They're not going to get my parts, are they?
We're going to read them. They're not going to get anywhere near your nether regions. If you want to hear episode two immediately, rather than waiting for a week, head over to patreon.com and search for Curiosity Specific. Hand over a very small amount of money and you get immediate access to all new episodes as soon as they're ready.
Ad-free.
You get a bunch of other stuff as well, don't you, Tim?
Yes, you'll get all the lovely show notes we give you with all these links, all these websites we've researched and bits of history, and the YouTube clips we found, all that lovely stuff.
And all the pictures and videos we took out on the road.
That's right, we've got some really great footage of the canal, actually.
Some really good stuff.
So if you get a real flavour of what Tower Hamlets looks like today, it's rather good.
So head over to patreon.com, have a search for Curiosity Specific. But this episode will be available in a week's time for free, wherever you're getting your podcasts. And we'll see you then.
Yes.
We're going to get to the lockkeeper's house, aren't we?
You're a bit worried about this, aren't you?
I don't really want to go there.
Well, it's all in the name of podcasting, Tim.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.